What up? Welcome to the Soulcast. Today's guest is Dr. Motherfucking Bones. Dr. Bones is a writer over at Gods and Radicals. He runs a webpage called The Conjure House. He recently released a book called Curse Your Boss, Hex the State, Take Back the World. Bones is an occultist, a hoodoo practitioner, an anarchist, who also identifies as an egoist communist. He runs a bi-weekly news and talk show with Brett from Revolutionary Left, who I did a show with a while ago called The Guillotine. It's a new project. It's really fucking dope. This interview, we're just going to kind of get into Bones' works, his ideas, and some of the greater themes that are throughout his work. We're going to talk about sort of the tensions between insurrectionary politics and more, you know, building the new world in the shell of the old stuff. We're going to lay out some of his critiques of quote-unquote leftist organizing in North America over the past, whatever, decade or so. Just going to talk about a whole bunch of shit. I'm going to talk about his approach to creating media and his approach to writing. We're going to talk about psychological operations and psychological warfare and how that in the games the state plays to kind of control and frame the way we think about things. This is a fucking awesome interview. We just covered so much ground. And I got to say, Bones is a fucking fascinating motherfucker. I mean, his writing style, the way he puts his shit together, it's a very prose-like, poetic way of writing and explaining shit, and it's covering new ground. And so it's always exciting to talk to people who are approaching things from a different perspective. Like, he's not necessarily strictly drawing from, you know, the typical bag of tricks that most radicals are drawing from. He's looking at models like, you know, the Hell's Angels, the Seminoles, and kind of like with the attitude of kind of take the best and leave the rest. He also is like a real big on Max Stirner, and Max Stirner is not someone I really know very much about. And so it was interesting to hear him talk about Max Stirner. During this interview, I talked about my homies in Unicorn Riot and their approach to journalism. And what I was trying to say is that they also do not buy that, you know, journalism is a neutral thing. However, they do journalism as journalism. Much respect to Unicorn Riot. I love the work they do and their approach. It's so fucking important and it's so vital. So as usual, if you dig this podcast, you know, feel free to go on iTunes, rate it, go to tinyurl.com/soulcast, subscribe, rate, review that shit. It helps me defeat the stupid ass fucking algorithms that want to destroy us. And if you want to support this podcast, go to soulone.org/soulcast. That's soulone.org/soulcast. And so we're going to just get ahead with this interview. But before we go through with the interview, let's hear from some homies in the Channel Zero Podcast Network.
Too busy trying to survive capitalism's daily grind to get caught up on the latest anarchist news? Or maybe you're so wrapped up in your own organizing that it's hard to make time to hear about other liberatory struggles. This Rebel Girl has got you covered. Tune in every Wednesday for new episodes of The Hotwire, a 30-minute podcast with the latest anarchist news, on-the-ground interviews, a repression roundup, political prisoner birthdays, and announcements for upcoming events. All this and more at crimethink.com.
Where did you get this?
Your friendly neighborhood anarchist. more of an anarchist militant.
People involved in social struggles than everybody else. You know?
People have been waiting for some content.
Radio. And show.
The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Percy Goodness.
The Final Straw Radio. Noblogs.org.
If you're listening, you are the resistance.
Dr. Bones, what up, man? Welcome to the motherfucking Soulcast.
Greetings and salutations, motherfucker. Sniz.
How's your day going?
Sold my ever disappearing time to the man from roughly 5 a.m. to 2, and then did client work. So, you know, once close to the grave, I suppose, and getting increasingly pissed off that I have to suffer under the horrible, horrible system we call capitalism. How about you?
Went to the doctor's, took my son to the doctor. That was a lot of fun. He was making some new sounds that resembled new words. I'm interested to see where he's going with that. Recorded a new song. No complaints.
There you go. Has your son developed any psychic powers yet? Have things started flying around the room?
He sees dead cops.
Well, he is truly blessed.
Oh, man. So to those people who don't know you, you know, you're
different.
A fucking fascinating character, you know. how would you describe yourself? And the work you do. You know, you're like a gonzo journalist.
Yeah, I multifaceted being, to say the least. I'm a gonzo journalist in the sense that, you know, gonzo really, really is a style. I take myself very seriously as a writer and as a journalist. So I'm analyzing current events, world events. I'm writing about them, and I'm not just writing about them, but I'm making emotional connections and bringing narratives to this. And, you know, when I got started writing, I always wanted to be a horror writer, you know, and then I realized that that's journalism today. That's where the real horror is, you know. It's true, you know, like, oh, wow, space aliens invade, you know. Oh, yeah, that's all good and well. But can it really compare to the absolute horror of, you know, a Syrian mother holding her child whose entrails are dripping out on her knees as it, you know, tries to mouth an I love you as, you know, American jets scream out overhead? You know, nothing can really compare to that. And that's real. That's real. That's really fucking happening. You know, it makes it all the more terrifying. So I write. I try to make sense of the world. My beat, my general sort of subject is the human condition, the human spirit as it exists under an absolute system of brutal slavery, and whether or not it'll either go extinct or break free. Then on top of that, I'm an occultist. I'm a hoodoo practitioner. So while other people are, you know, playing Xbox or whatever, I'm out in the graveyard cajoling dead people to help me win at gambling. I help people chase negative entities and spirits out of their house, help lovers reunite or rekindle all sorts of stuff. It's very, very interesting. I read cards for clients, so I'm constantly peering open the varied realms of probability and possibility and helping people pick good choices. One of the most interesting readings I had over a series of a week was I had some very anonymous client that wanted to remain anonymous in Germany that wanted me to do a whole series of readings for an underwear line. I don't know who the underwear line was for, but I mean, it was fascinating to basically, like, for 3 days, just question after question in regards to this specific underwear line that was being launched. So, you know, so I really felt like an internationalist at that point, helping people with their underwear designing, you know, some weird swamp wizard / journalist from the savage, unpredictable meth lands of Florida.
That's funny. Well, you know, I mean, because, you know, if it doesn't go right, you know, underwear could be swampy, you know, if it doesn't have
Indeed, it could. The
proper ventilation. You know?
Absolutely. Rub the skin raw. Next thing you got a rash, an infection, and then you keel over and die. It's terrible business.
So, okay, this is a question. Do you did you go to college?
Oh, God, no. I don't have the fucking money for that. Hell no.
You're not an art school kid. You didn't study. Because, man, I'll tell you, like, straight up, when I read your writing, you know, like the prose style, like your style of writing is –
you know, really dope. It's really poetic. It just, it has like a real fluid language to it. And, you know, I'm surprised to hear that you didn't go to college.
No, I mean, I've studied, I mean, definitely when I decided I wanted to be a writer, I decided I was going to take my craft, you know, seriously. And one of the things that has helped me is to view it not necessarily as like just writing, but as an art. You know, there's a real art to it. You know, you're painting with words. And so I've read a few books and stuff like that that really helped me understand Storycraft by Jack Hart, which is probably the Bible of narrative nonfiction, has helped me immensely. And then just studying as well authors that I felt close to, Hunter S. Thompson, you know, Bukowski, not just studying them as, but analyzing the specific techniques and things like that they're using and peering into their lives and how everything worked. It's, you know, been an interesting sort of journey. And, you know, I look back at my older pieces and it's like, you definitely see like, oh, wow, I've improved. And again, I have to really thank Reed, the editor of Gods and Radicals, who, you know, sort of, I sent him a manuscript. He picked me up and, you know, he sort of guided me through it, because writing online is a totally different ballgame than any other, you know. And after, you know, selling horrible, you know, all sorts of like drafts for internet journalism under a whole bunch of different pseudonyms and making absolutely jack shit, you know, I combined that sort of internet journalism with, you know, real art and fused it with poltergasmic politics and, you know, sort of found my home. But no education, just and that's one of the things that I think also my readers really enjoy is, you know, I'm a working class person. I'm not well off. I am not well to do. I have never been to college. I've never, you know, had a whole shitload of money plop on my lap. I, you know, fucking, you know, barely survived just like anybody else. I'm in the thick of it. You know, I feel that anvil of pain and pressure of not having insurance, of, you know, having a pet get sick and knowing that your entire savings may very well be annihilated, but you have to keep this animal alive. And then what if you don't? You know, what if you spend $1,000 or, you know, $800 on a surgery and it doesn't save the animal, and now you're you know, completely blasted in poverty? That pain, you know, that real experience, that's what I wanted to write about. And it's for working class people. It's about working class people. And I think it really resonates with the human experience as we find it today.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is something I really like about your work. It's, you know, I'm friends, like some of my best friends are like the Unicorn Riot people. I hang out with them all the time. And they're like, you know, a lot of them are anarchists and like they question the legitimacy of like the state as like the arbiter of like, you know, whatever, our reality. But at the same time, you know, there's always like this need to like be neutral, you know. And then I don't know if you know this dude, this person, Kit O'Connell. Do you know Kit? Kit O'Connell is a journalist out of Austin, and they're the only other person I know of who is like rocking the Gonzo journalist label. And for me, I'm always like in the middle where I'm like, I don't see myself as a journalist at all, because I'm not neutral. Like, I'm a propagandist, you know? And what I like about Gonzo journalism is, like, you can stride all those, you can straddle all those different worlds and also personalize it. And so it.
Yeah. Absolutely. When one of the things Thompson talked about is there is no such thing as objective journalism. There never has been. You know, back in the 50s when both Republicans and Democrats picked up a New York Times and read what they said and then debated over what, you know, this perceived reality was, what they didn't realize at the time was that the New York Times still had a bias. It still had an American bias. It still had a capitalist bias. It was still writing from an extremely subjective standpoint. It just dressed it up as objective. And one of the things that Thompson said, you know, it was like, you know, Nixon was the perfect example of the failure of quote unquote objective journalism, because on paper, Nixon seemed great. You know, longtime politician, great Republican, you know, he's made friends in all the right places. What's wrong with this guy? But it took a subjective lens. You had to look at that motherfucker and just sense the pure piss and shit coming out of his mouth and just lying all the time and just look at him as a crooked scrawny little screwdriver of a man that wanted to fuck each and every person who ever wronged him. That kind of subjective experience, that impressionistic journalism, is what Thompson really pioneered in his early stuff. You know, one of the things that's really sad about Thompson, which he ended up ruining quite to the end of his days, was, you know, Thompson just got pinned as like, oh, crazy drug guy does stuff. You know, wow. And this was a guy who really, really studied his craft, really, you know, worked hard to be a writer. And some of his early stuff, especially, you know, when this guy's going out with the Hell's Angels, you know, and he's writing about not just what, you know, the Hell's Angels rode from here to here, but he's just, you know, what did it feel like? What did it smell like? What's the personal story behind a guy named Tiny that wears a top hat? You know, what do the scars on his face mean? There's all these different layers of symbolism and meaning and everything like that woven into the stories. And I think maybe one of the things that really led me to Gonzo journalism is, you know, I am from Florida, which is sort of kind of a southern state. You know, my grandfather was from Kentucky, very much the sort of stereotypical Kentucky lawyer. He never got into law school because he ended up having kids, but he was studying to be a lawyer. And there's very much a tradition in the South of storytelling. We relate everything to stories, to folk tales, to natural events. You know, there's a strong tradition in the South of metaphor and simile. You know, it's all about this bringing this subjective, real experience. And it's also about power, because you know, the CIA and all these different organizations have studied how powerful narratives are. Okay, the human species is the narrative species. In our heads, we're constantly telling a story. And when you can control the story people are telling, you control the way they interpret the world, right? So if I'm a journalist and there's, you know, we've seen it time and time again, a Nazi scumbag piece of shit that knifes someone. Right. If I'm a quote unquote objective journalist, troubled youth, had so much promise, I'm framing the story. And what I find so fascinating about the power of writing, and Tom Wolfe wrote about this, is words in particular have a interesting ability to create pictures within the mind. Now, when you're at home watching a movie, the images are given to you, and you just sort of accept them. But words specifically sort of cause images to fruit in your head. So if I'm writing about a politician, right, and I describe him as rodent-like, with just using that word, I've already shifted the way you will interpret that politician for the rest of the segment, maybe even for the rest of your life. I've crafted an image, and that's how you're going to respond to it. And then you can go way deep into it, like the CIA does, where you're picking specific subliminal words to generate specific emotional responses. So again, I don't think there has ever been such thing as objective journalism. And like I've told other anarchists, because there is sadly a long tradition in anarchism of sort of, you know, saying fuck the media, fuck. And the problem is, if you don't control the narrative, if you don't control your story, someone else will. And it is almost always the enemy.
Right on. Well, you know, it's funny because this kind of really gets into one of the other questions I had for you that I really liked in your book is, like, you know, when you were describing like the precarity of everyday life, in your book, curse
your boss, hex the state, take back the world.
So you were talking about, like, you know, one of the things I was like happy to see in there was like all the stuff about Edward Bernays in marketing and like the birth of PR and how they use psychology to control people. And, you know, if we look at, like, I don't know, I saw this article the other day about how Instagram is, like, you know, throttling people's likes if they're not checking the app enough, and how, you know, I just think about like the Edward Bernays shit of the past, and like, you know, what that is today, and like this world of Facebook and algorithms, and how we, you know, we're basically like, we're already under the thumb of like robot AI, you know?
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. And I mean, and that's like, I come from two generations of car salesmen. So I was kind of like born or maybe picked up on the specific sort of mindset. And back when I was in high school, I just was fascinated by the subject. I read the U.S. Army PsyOps manual. I read anything I could get my hands on body language, you know, just anything to sort of like see the sort of larger picture that was going on. And there's a great text called Influence. It's actually used as the textbook for marketing classes. And it's all about illustrating how easily the human mind can be led and tricked and basically into behaviors that it doesn't want to do. And again, people don't realize that, you know, we live in this age of soft power. It's about mind fucking you. In fact, the Army's Psychological Operations Division, they have a phrase that, you know, our wounds don't heal. So they're really going – perfect example. And for all you aspiring con artists out there, keep this in mind. In Influence, there was actually a study. It was an experiment. They had the experimenter. They had someone who was pretending to be another sort of subject who was actually in with the experimenters, and then they had the actual subject. And so they had these two people in a room, and they created this fake experiment. Like, hey, we're going to test you on so-and-so, blah-blah-blah, I'll be right back. So, you know, the two subjects, and again, one is in on the whole experiment, are talking a little bit, and the experimenter comes back. He gives them a fake test. Both people take a fake test. The experimenter says, okay, I'm going to be right back. The fake subject says, is it cool if I go grab a drink real quick? Yeah, sure. Goes, he gets a drink. Comes back with two Cokes, two Coca-Colas. And he says, well, I was getting one, so I figured I'd give you one. Gives it as a gift. Oh, wow. Hey, thanks a lot. About 20 minutes later, the experimenter pretending to be a subject says, hey, you know, by the way, my workplace is having this raffle. And if I win, I could win a car. It's about $5 a ticket. Do you think you could buy a couple? 86% of the people that he bought that Coke for ended up buying the tickets. So that's a return investment of like what you spent $1, you're getting back $5, and depending on the multiples. And they did the experiment again without the Coke, where it's just, hey, I'm asking you for money. And it was like 20 or 30%. And what's interesting is they had these people take a person out. What did you think of Bob? Did you like Bob? And even the people that personally didn't like the person that bought them the coat, you know, like, yeah, fuck Bob, that miserable Pete. I don't like the way he dresses and he smells like shit. But because this gift mechanism had been pushed in their mind that, look, I give you something, you're going to give me something back. 80% of the time. So where back in the day, the Hare Krishnas, that's what it was part of their program. They would give you a flower and they say, this is a gift. As soon as you take that gift, you're obligated. It's a subconscious psychological lever that con men and politicians and advertisers play like a motherfucking piano. And I what I find interesting is it's in our political discourse, right? Oh, someone died for your freedom of speech, man. They you know, freedom isn't free. Someone paid for that. You know, America's given you this. You've been gifted your freedom. Now I'm obligated. Psychologically, I feel obligated, and I will do things that I may not necessarily do, even damaging myself. So again, people don't realize that there's so much of this psychological mind fuckery going on a daily basis. They live in it, they eat it, they worship it. It's in everything. Our brands, you know, determine our behavior. They've, you know, it's simply incredible. People walk around like Apple is a new fucking Jesus, for Christ's sake. You know? Oh well, as Apple users, I have to say, what the fuck is that? You happen to buy a product and all of a sudden it gives you a personality? You know, this is an age of cults. We have the cult of CrossFit, the cult of Apple, anything to give you a motherfucking personality. And as long as you get that personality, whatever it asks of you, most people are willing to do it. Coupled with obvious propaganda techniques, you know, creating strong images, repeating certain narratives, and again, that sort of gift lever. And you can make people do damn near fucking anything you want.
Damn. Well, you know, one thing I'll say is I'm sure you've read these articles where they talk about, like, because Apple products are so sleekly designed that when we're using them, it actually triggers the same part of our brain as a religious experience.
Oh, yeah, and that's not by accident. It's like a lot of people think, like Newt Gingrich was famous for this, you know. Here's just this old white dickwad being an asshole. And probably Newt Gingrich was the first person to actually employ people to study the psychological effect of certain words. He would have them tested. He would have them focus group. So like what appears to us to be just off the cuff comments, like for instance, okay, perfect example. Anybody remember George Bush horribly mispronouncing, you know, Saddam Hussein? Saddam Hussein, it's like, what the fuck? Saddam, yeah. You know, Saddam Hussein. He had actually been coached to deliberately mispronounce it in the hope that it would create a psychological link between legends of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Really?
Okay. He was capable of saying the right fucking thing, but he'd been coached by all these White House people that it would generate a sort of psychological link and a sort of cross reference by mispronouncing it and generating it. And again, this is what I'm talking about when I say that these words have fucking power. You know, in fact, there's one psychological technique where it's like you sort of marry two words. So like you pick a word that will end in S-E and then the next word starts with X or something like that. Or, you know, you pick a word that ends with S and begins with E-X. So subconsciously, the word sex is right there. And while you may not be aware of it, subconsciously you are. And all of a sudden, you know, you get just the sheer word alone increases, you know, chemicals in your body. It moves your brain into another place and you're none the wiser. You know, these beer commercials that have all these scantily clad women around some dude drinking fucking Bud Light, it's not by accident. You know, it's not like these are million-dollar PR firms that are funding research labs to determine what works. Everything you see on the big name commercials, whether it's from fucking Gatorade, Nike, everything. This has been focus grouped again and again and again and again. It's been debated over meetings. They've done studies. They've analyzed every piece. So what appears to you to just be some glib remark or some, you know, stupid campaign to get you to buy something has been totally focused basically to get up in your head and fuck you six ways from Sunday.
That's fucked up. I mean, I had no idea about Bush. That's hilarious also. But it's not like Trump is doing that, you know? Jesus Christ, man, what a mess. That reminds me of, as you're talking about like the gift economy, and first I'd be remiss to say, hey, you know, I make this podcast, it's free, and you know, and people appreciate it, so they support it on Patreon. And I definitely, you know, there's a distinction, I think, to draw there between, like, you know, the way we do it, the way the capitalists do it, you know? And it reminds me of, like, you know, these distinctions between, like, this term potlatch, which is, you know, popularized to me by the Situationists, but it was a thing used by Native American tribes, I think, in the Northwest, where, like, you know, they would give a gift, but the gift would be like a loaded gift. The gift would like build reputation. And when I think about that in like connection with like mutual aid, where we're actually like, you know, instead of giving someone to fish, you're teaching them how to fish, or Black Panther breakfast programs. Like these are projects that are meant to like empower and strengthen communities. And sometimes, you know, sometimes like we call shit mutual aid when really it's charity, you know? And I think it gets into, you know, just a whole, like, there's a, like, with the gift economy and all the shit that's happening right now, like, we're in, like, weird fucking waters, you know? It's a really confusing economic and psychic terrain to be navigating.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, you know, it's the classic struggle of trying to fight against a system you despise but having to live inside it. Now, you know, if I could fucking live on a piece of property with a group of people and, you know, I would love to be able to, like, just be like that hoodoo man in a root shack doing work for whoever the fuck comes by. But that requires at the same time that I can fucking eat, you know, that I can dress myself, that I have a sufficient supply of booze, you know. And capitalism is not just an accidental phenomenon. You know, you remember the enclosure movement, everything like that. We working people have been strip mined of every resource to where all we have is cash. So the cash, its value is determined by people outside of our control. So we're literally passing around these, you know, digital numbers that we have no fucking control over, that we're wholly dependent on because we have no other resources. You know, if you like a specific writer, you can't say, well, you know what? I got a house. Come here. I own 40 acres of property. You stay here. You just do your thing. You just do your fucking thing. I support you. This is fantastic. Here, I got a garden too. Let's start growing food and everything like that. We don't have those structures. So really, right now, the entire sort of revolutionary movement is trying to claw itself out of poverty. And this is the classic capitalist game. You know, as soon as people start gaining power and gaining traction, you got to destroy it. You got to keep them in a precarious position. If they're so worried about paying their bills or not being able to survive, they're not going to have time to organize. They're not going to do it. And one of the things, you know, I talked about in my book is like, my God, you know, how many fucking great artists have we lost to the 9-to-5 fucking grind? You know, how many fucking Michelangelos, how many fucking just incredible artistic geniuses have we watched slowly kill themselves at a fucking Walmart, at a goddamn Target, at a fucking gas station? How many of those motherfuckers, because they feel the need to create and that have tried to do it and have been unable to support themselves and have just sold their soul down the shitter, end up putting a fucking, you know, gun in their mouth and blowing their brains out across the room?
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, as an artist, as a full-time artist, I mean, I could say even when you're a successful artist, it's not much different. I mean, to really be able to do it means, you know, you're going to be touring your whole fucking life. And that touring is boring. It's a lot of standing around and waiting in clubs, sitting in cars. Like, you have to be fucking high half of the time. Otherwise, how are you going to sit in a car for fucking 12 hours and sit around in a club for 6 hours? And then, like, the rush of adrenaline, like, turns people into alcoholics and drug addicts. And so when I look at, like, the artists who are, like, you know, legends, you know, they're fucking dying at age 55. They're dying at age 50. Like, the art, like, even a successful artist in this society, you know, you don't get to be Michelangelo hanging out and, you know, working on one painting for 6 years. Like, you got to make a painting, then you got to make your video for social media, then you got to have like 300 clever tweets about your painting, and you know, you only have 2 weeks to make that painting, and you better make another one or the world's already forgot about you.
Exactly. And you still there?
Yeah, I'm not going anywhere.
Oh, I had it sounded like you faded out for a minute. No, you're absolutely right. Like, that's one of the things that, you know, I originally sort of came from the world of like internet journalism, where like you are paid by the page view. Okay, people don't realize that the majority of the news that they eat up is specifically designed, number one, to cause outrage with those lovely clickbait titles. It's all for page views. It's all for fucking every bit that they write on these sites with ads is designed for page views. The data itself is not necessarily the most important thing. Anything they can fucking do to draw that traffic in. And so it fucks up all the writing. It fucks up everything. And, you know, I have thought about the same thing too, because, you know, as a writer, you know, it's like, you know, you read about these greats, you know, and it's like, God, you know, Thompson was fucking chilling with Hell's Angels. He had his own fucking place in Colorado, you know, and here I am, fucking 4:30 a.m. I'm drinking a half lukewarm cup of coffee. Truck's going to be late. I guarantee you we already got a call out, so I'm looking at a fucking 12-hour day.
At the gas station.
I'm not going to be able – yeah, I'm not going to be able to take a lunch because I have to get this fucking truck done. So when I come home and finally eat, the rush of the blood sugar is literally going to knock me the fuck out, so I'll pass out from between 4 and 8. And then I'll have to be in bed at 11 to get back up at 4 a.m. You know, it's like we live in an era of absolute desperation. And I mean, there are – I think writers may have a little – like – something about writing destroys people, or it's either destroys people or they're just souls on their way to destruction, perhaps. But I mean, like, one of the things that inspires me, at least, or gives me hope, should I say, is Bukowski. He worked at a fucking post office for 12 years. I mean, the most menial, horrible, mindless task. And this guy was turning out poems that are just, you know, simply incredible. You know, so it's like, but I think also that the people that are, you know, sort of making these roses grow up in the concrete, those flowers, those expressions of art and creativity that we are seeing rise out of this barbed wire jungle that we call precarious living and capitalism are some of the most pungent and aromatic and lovely because they have suffered. You know, the pain is there. You really have to fucking hurt for this. You have to do it. Even if you know, it's something you're compelled to do and you're ready to bleed for it. And I think that's the mark of, you know, really great artists is, you know, you have to do it. You're driven to it. If I don't write, I feel sick. Like there's like a physical illness that comes over me and I'm constantly reading and thinking and analyzing and everything like that. Before I started writing, I would get into these arguments with people online, right? And when someone really pissed me off, I'd like sit down and I'd write out a fucking 5,000 word essay for a Facebook comment. So the point where once, you know, eventually my wife is like, what the fuck? You know, like this dude said one thing and you responded with a 5,000 word thing with sources and everything. Like, what are you doing? Like, you know, like, what the fuck? He responded with a Pepe meme. Like, what did you win here? So it's like you just feel the compulsion, you know, it's you just feel compelled to create. And this is our time. It's a time of precarity. It's a time of struggle. It's a time of desperation and everybody's feeling the hurt. And I think that we're all sort of learning what an artist is in a time of subjugation and a time of war. This is what it is to be an artist. You know, it's to struggle, it's to hurt. And, you know, I'm just hoping like hell that the CIA doesn't capture me and rip my balls off. I mean, that's my hope. If they're going to get me, I hope, fuck, please God, just put a bullet in my head, make it very swift. Don't send me those black sites. And if you do, I will haunt you. I will haunt you and I will possess your children and I will take out every battery in your remotes and spit blood on all of your bodies as a ghost because fuck you, CIA.
Well, I, you know, it will probably be the FBI, you know, hope, you know, but
I would like to think, you know, I maybe get a pay increase there, you know, maybe the CIA, you know, if the FBI came, I'd kind of be disappointed.
Yeah,
you know,
like I didn't really just make the FBI. I didn't really do it right.
Yeah, damn it. What is this, the NSA? Fuck, come on, man. Wow, this is really awesome. Hurting my street, man.
Oh, man. So someone you talk about a lot, I've never read, you know, Max Stirner. You know, what is it about Max Stirner that you think people should know, and you know, what does he have to, what's so great about Max Stirner?
Max Stirner, he was light years ahead of his time. We're talking about a guy in the early 1800s talking about how gender is, you know, a construct created by society. Max Stirner was friends with Engels. He knew Marx. He argued with him. Engels was smitten with Stirner. Engels actually wrote a poem about Max Stirner. And in one of the lines about the poem is like, you know, everybody else is saying down with kings. And Max Stirner is saying, yes, and down with laws too. Max Stirner has this amazing approach to things that it doesn't just deconstruct this. It doesn't just deconstruct capitalism. It goes a step further. You know, what is society? What is humanity? Max Stirner's theory is that these ideas of things, he calls them geists or spooks or phantoms, we take these ideas of things as more real. So, for instance, you know, you have these people, oh, what? I'm a man. This is what man do. The idea of man, of this loaded concept, is a sort of like psychic image in their head that is literally dictating their behavior, their thoughts, the way they live. The real subject is beholden or haunted or possessed by this image. They're not an individual anymore, merely a facet, merely an appendage upon this image that it uses to get around. Not only that, Cerner, his revolutionary subject isn't necessarily the worker, because Max Stirner says he wants to go beyond. He doesn't just want the workers to take back what's theirs. He wants them to basically abolish themselves as workers. Max Stirner says, you're not a worker. You're not. You're not a human being either. You're unique. Each and every one of you is unique in a totally different way. We live minute by minute ourselves constantly. You're indescribable. And I saw an immediate – there's a huge overlap between Max Stirner's work in Buddhism and Taoism, which apparently Max Stirner was there for some of I think Hegel's. Is that how you pronounce it? Hegel. However, his sort of lectures on Eastern philosophy. So there's a very big chance that Max Stirner was actually about Taoism and Buddhism and sort of brought it into a Western political lens. And one of the things that I found the easiest to describe Max Stirner as unique, you know, Max Stirner talks about the you that is named is not the real you, right? So soul, for instance, that's an image. It nowhere near describes the totality of you. The you that's with your family, the you that's alone, the you that's, you know, outside in your garden interacting with your plants. Max Stirner is arguing that we fight for the liberation of the totality of that uniqueness. He wants you to be totally free from the labels, from the positions, from the class dynamic that has been forced upon you by people, but also by these ideas that have been replicated like viruses through people. One of the things that I find a very interesting parallel is the Greek idea of gnosis, which is a very, very big occultist term. So the Greeks have many different words for knowledge. And gnosis is a specific word for a specific kind of knowledge. So if I say, I know algebra, okay, that means I have a knowledge of what algebra is, how it works. I could probably use it. When I say I know my brother, that speaks to a deeper knowledge. I know what he's like in certain situations. I know his different feelings and motivations. And I, after studying him and living amongst him for X amount of years, I grasp him in a way, in almost unspeakable way that many people don't. And even that is a limited aspect. That's not his full unique. In fact, only he can know his full unique. So Max Stirner's, one of the things that's interesting is Max Stirner says, a revolution aims at new arrangements. Max Stirner doesn't want new arrangements. He wants an insurrection, which is a uprising of the individual above the arrangements, a total repainting of the world with your creative hand, united with others. Every system, every idea, ruthlessly put to a scalpel of how does this serve us and does it fit our unique? Are we allowed to express ourselves fully as individuals? And that's one of the things specifically is, you look at some of the videos or propaganda from like the Soviet Union or whatever. And it's these people in factories, you know, they're still hitting that time clock, you know, there's this bureaucracy and everything like that. The working class may have held the power in the state, but they were still the working class. They were still a group of human beings with multifaceted existences and desires and wants and needs and dreams and hopes that were regulated to an economic existence purely. They were an economic unit that generated value. That is who they were. That is what a worker is. So Max Stirner has inspired the FAI. He inspired the illegalists. He's inspired actually quite a few different anarchist movements, his individualism. And it's an individualism that isn't necessarily – you know, often in the left, we have a sour taste in our mouth about individualism because it's been harped by the United States about individualism. Well, capitalism – and Stirner argues – this in his book, that capitalism is antithetical to individualism. Because as long as I'm selling my ass to my boss. I'm not a fucking individual. When I'm on the clock in a uniform, I'm not me. I'm somebody else. I'm whoever the fuck it happens to be that my boss is willing to pay me to be. Just the same as when a single mother has to work two or three jobs just to feed her kids. She doesn't have time to be an individual. She doesn't have time to pursue her dreams. She doesn't have time to maybe engage with that creative desire deep within her heart to paint or to photograph. She's no longer an individual. She just is this cut up being that's a mother, that's a worker, and that's all she gets to exist as. You know, and Max Stern is saying, God, this is terrible. And the only way that we're going to get through that is through power. Taking your own power. You know, Max Stirner isn't arguing for elections. He's not arguing for strikes. Max Stirner's talking about, in his book, if someone has something you want, go and take it. Get rid of these ideas of right and wrong that have been handed to you by a group of overseers that have whipped you and run your entire life. There is no right and wrong. There's only what's right for you. And what's wrong for you? Look out the world in that aspect and seize what you require.
That's awesome. Yeah, I really resonate with a lot of that stuff. And as you're describing Stirner, it's reminding me a little of sort of the Invisible Committee stuff that I like. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see if they're influenced by him. But... So this is one of my things that like I'm wondering about though. So you're an anarchist, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you also identify as an egoist communist. And in my mind, when I, to me, that's what an anarchist is. You know, like I'm an anarchist. I don't want to live in I don't want to work in the people's anarcho-syndicalist Amazon factory. You know, I want to live in
worker-controlled McDonald's.
Yeah, I want to live in the world you describe, you know, but to me that's anarchism. You know, that's and so I wonder why it's important to you to rep egoist communism and not. To me, I think there's more power in saying, in throwing the gauntlet down for anarchism and saying, look, here's a strain that all these people are already engaging in. Like why egoist communism?
Well, I think number one, the exact reason you said before you described yourself as an anarchist, you had to predicate and say, and by the way, you know, I'm not this kind of anarchist. Well, that's exactly that. You know, not only I'm raising this flag that this is what I'm about. This is what I think. If you like it, let's all get in it together. But also, egoism takes several steps that anarchism doesn't, at least a large amount of anarchist theory. Number one, the egoism absolutely criticizes the idea of a society. Society is a construct. It's not real. Okay. And it also lobbies some criticisms against the revolutionary idea, the holy religious foundation of the working class. You know, that's a hard, long existing thing in anarchism and the left in general, that the working class is sacred, that they are these holy religious figures that are just two steps away from the most liberated, amazing communistic individuals. You know, it's like the same guys that are working at Sunoco on Monday and burning crosses in your fucking yard on Thursday. Just the sheer fact that they exist under wage labor, man, they just are so close to being revolution. No. Egoism isn't about that. Egoism is
anarchism's not. Anarchism's not. I mean, I don't think anarchism sees it that way. I mean, when I think, you know.
Well, anarcho-syndicalism, with its the commune itself is the revolutionary agent, not the individual. I would say there's how many anarchists really take the idea that there is going to be no law and no cops seriously, no prisons? Just because the commune says something, just because the free assembly, the general assembly. The egoist says, I'm not bound by anything they say. If I like it, I might agree with it, but I'm not bound by anything. anything but my own desires and my own will. And it's a very dangerous freedom.
See, again, but it's also I'm totally on board with that. I'm totally on board with all that shit. But I just feel like that's, to me, that's like basic crime think stuff. Like crime think is very much like, fuck a General Assembly. You have autonomy. You are an individual, you know.
Crime think has also definitely read a hell of a lot of Max Stirner and been influenced by it. But why I would say specifically also egoist communism is where the revolutionary praxis is, I am not fighting for society. I'm not fighting for the working class. I'm not fighting for humanity. I'm not fighting for planet Earth. I'm not. Personally, I think we are on a fucking hell train to nowhere. What I am fighting for is small groups and bands of individuals uniting together to fight for their own lives. If the rest of the world goes to hell, that may be totally out of my hands. And there's no point in me beating myself up about it. Egoist communism is, in a sense, an anarchism and a communism with you and your loved ones against the world, an adversarial aspect. So again, if I compare the actions of the FAI to a large amount of anarchist organizing, they're two totally different fucking beasts. Absolutely. Your average person committing arsons and bombings in the FAI that is refusing to be labeled by anything and doesn't give a fuck about bombing mass transit and that it may inconvenience some workers, because in their mind, it's them and their loved ones against the state. So in essence, rather, if I were to, like, again, and I'm not claiming this historical movement is egoist communist, but what I'm saying is I'm looking at, like, the Seminoles. The Seminoles were not existing to liberate the United States. They had no intention of establishing a new government across the United States. They were fighting for a way of life amongst them and the ones they loved, a way of life that specifically was multiracial, that was anti-hierarchical, a real life worth living for. That's what I'm fighting for, and I'm trying to find as many individuals like that. Egoist communism, they are the sort of renegades, the pirates of the anarchist movement that says, look, I don't know about you. I'm in this for me. I want to get free. The working class may just well sell its ass to Amazon or, you know, be, you know, digitized or have their consciousness uploaded to, insane binary system that somehow turns hentai into pure fuel. I don't know. But what I'm concerned about is, number one, myself, and number two, getting the ones I love free.
And I do think there is a lot of power in recognizing that it's okay to, you know, to advocate for yourself. You know, I think there are tendencies within, especially within quote unquote activism, where it's like, oh, you know, you have to constantly be self-sacrificing, and then, you know, it's like you're just engaging in all this, like, you know, you're beating yourself over the head and you're wondering like, oh, I'm out there, I'm risking my life for this, you know, working class, and, you know, why haven't the workers joined me? And then next thing you know, you've spent your whole life doing that, and you never got to go sailing, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the things, especially as being someone of the, you know, leftist persuasion in the South, you know, we in the South, we're surrounded by enemies. These people don't want to enter a dialogue with you. They aren't interested in what the fuck you want to say. They want you dead, okay? So, you know, egoism says, why the fuck do I have to wait for the most ass-backwards dickwads in Mississippi to get educated to, quote-unquote, get woke when I want to be free today? And egoist communism says, I, along with other individuals, how can we unite as this collection of individuals working together to supply ourselves with freedom at the cost of the wider world?
I mean all that sounds great to me. I mean, the devil's advocate would say that approach is privileged, like to say, oh, you know, me and my friends, we've gained resources. But it's like, how can you talk about privilege when you're working at a
it depends on the situation. you know, if we're talking about a group of, you know, upper middle class people buying a property and starting a commune, yeah, you absolutely have privilege. But when I see, again, historical examples like the pirate ships, okay, these were people, runaway slaves, escaped convicts, the lowest of the low in British society. They were jumping on these ships and they were saying, look, we want to be free. We don't want to, you know, have our ass beat by the British Navy. What can we do? And all these pirate ships actually drew up articles of confederation that had very clear, like, look, the loot will be distributed equally. We're going to elect our captain. If one of us is hurt, they're going to get a certain amount of loot so that they can support themselves. And these were decided as individuals. So these individuals were uniting to find freedom in a world that would deny it them. And they certainly weren't privileged. Again, looking at sort of the organizational model, when you see the big organizational models I see for US communism are how mafias work, how the Hell's Angels works, how the Seminoles in roughly the Seminole War periods, about a 40-year period in the 1800s, work. How do these worlds that are created, that are different than the world outside them, function? How do they succeed? How do they grow? Privilege can come from anywhere, and it's absolutely, of course, essential to acknowledge it. But at the same time, we all want to be free. We all want to be free, even if you may be middle class, even if you're working class, even if you're fucking, you know, homeless. If you're all these different things, we can acknowledge our privilege, and we can also all acknowledge the same desire that we all want to be free, that we're all being crushed under this, that no one fucking wants this. No one wants this fucking bullshit world with its 84 Starbucks down the same goddamn street. Nobody wants – look at the suicide rates in this fucking country, man, the overdoses. Does anybody fucking want this place? And so it's us saying, look, this is not cutting it. You, what can we do to get free? And, you know, the speaker of privilege, again, the FAI, we're talking about comrades spread all over the world. We're talking about insurrectionary anarchists who, again, probably wouldn't label themselves egoist communists, but the specific praxis I'm talking about, where it's a group of individuals trying to get free against the world. These people are in Chile, they're in Argentina, they're in Russia, they're in Mexico, and last time I checked, those places aren't necessarily bastions of privilege. So I think it's a necessary critique. It's certainly a light that we have to shine on ourselves to analyze what we're doing. But at the same token, what I'm seeing is, look, let's look at the leftist organizing we've been doing, and let's look at the Hell's Angels. Okay, now if the DSA decides tomorrow that they're going to rise up against the United States, I don't think the FBI is going to give a fuck. But if, you know, but if tomorrow the Hell's Angels flew a goddamn hammer and sickle or a circle A and said that, you know, they're anti-capitalists and they are against, they might get fucking worried. They've created worlds within themselves, and those worlds have the potential to expand and seize territory. You know, it's absolutely, I still call myself an anarchist. I am an anarchist. Egoist communism is a specific tendency within anarchism. You know, when we're arguing for communism, we add the communist bit because we're advocating a classless, stateless existence where we're no longer bought and sold by currency, and where the entirety of property lives determined by property relations is non-existent. So it's the easiest way I can really put it is that it's, you know, it's a pirate flag. It's a pirate flag lifted up that describes a certain set of tendencies, that describes a certain set of practices, and each person that flies that flag is giving an open invitation to other comrades that are saying, hey, if these are things you like, let's unite together, rather than joining endless assembly meetings or, I don't know, maybe like voting in an anarchist senator.
So, okay, so this is probably, you know, I guess my toughest question for you. You were just talking about, you know, the informal anarchist federation and the conspiracy cells of fire and these Greek groups. And, you know, I've spent some time in Greece, and, like, you know, And to me, there, it seems like there's some tension between, like, those groups are almost more nihilistic, you know, in their approach.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas have groups like, you know, the Hell's Angels, you're talking about, like, they're not nihilists. These are people who creating community. They're organized. They're caring for one another. And so when we're, you know, when we're talking about, you know, fostering relationships with, like, everyday people or lifting ourselves up out of these horrible conditions, I feel like, you know, these more nihilistic insurrectionary groups that, you know, you talk about, it seems to be at odds with people like the Hell's Angels. And I guess I just wonder, like, you know, what do you have to say about that? Like, you know, if we talk about, like, building communities and, like, having places for, you know, our friends to, you know, build pirate utopias together, like, that to me seems very different than, you know, just insurrectionary attacks that don't necessarily increase our power. You understand? You know what I mean?
I think, yeah, no, I hear you. There are certain things that obviously I disagree with, like some cells of the FAI and insurrectionary anarchism are so over the top with their nihilism that, you know, it's like, fuck everything. And, you know, like, it's just like this incoherent scream and all you can do is blow shit up. You know, I get that. But I think if we're talking about all these members, and specifically the conspiracy of Cells of Fire, they started out in anarchist assemblies. So even while they were committing attacks, they were still part of the larger anarchist movement. They just decided that they weren't going to be bound by the larger movement. And by and large, the larger Greek anarchist movement supported them until the heat started coming down and the arrests started. And then nobody wanted to go to jail. So, hey, fuck those guys. But we talk about, you know, the Hell's Angels and everything like that. But one of the big things that I think, okay, if we're talking about maybe a more politically neutral idea to further for anarchist organizing is the old school fraternal organizations, right? If you were a Moose member, okay, there was a place you could go in town that was like a safe spot. You could have a beer. You could have a meal at a very, very discounted price. Back in the early 1900s, they actually provided health care. So you could go to a doctor for a much discounted rate. So the idea was that all these members were going to unite their resources and their abilities to care for one another, to provide a better standard of life, because at that time, the United States didn't give a fuck. So taking that model and then wedding it to the idea that we are fighting against a system that wants to kill us, I am not saying all of us should be martyrs and rush up to the, you know, nearest police station and, you know, blow it up or anything like that. I'm not saying that at all. In fact, I think the sort of criminal mindset of seeing opportunity where it is, but not necessarily, you know, not blowing your cover. No one's going to respect a person that walks into a bank in broad daylight and tries to rob it for the quote unquote anarchist movement with no mask on, with a gun that they just bought, with a gigantic shirt with their name and address all over it. You know, I'm not going to respect that. You know, just because you thought you were an ultra cool nihilist, you know, okay, great. You literally failed at everything you tried to do. Congratulations. But I think that the insurrectionists are right in the idea that, you know, this is a system that we have to attack. And when I look at militant organizations that have inspired fear in the police, fear in the established order, Black Panthers, this, you know, that's a great example of sort of organizing within your community to provide basic necessities for the betterment of the community, but also taking a stance that, yes, we are against the larger world. Same with the Hell's Angels, same with the Mafia, same with the illegalist gangs that were running around in France in the early 1900s. You know, this is a world that isn't going to go away by, you know, forming a union. You collectively own your McDonald's. That's great. It does not stop capitalism. If it has to give you a little bit of room to live, it will, but it won't destroy it. The only thing that's going to destroy it is war, because that's the way it was founded. That is the only – we've been every myth and falsehood we could give ourselves to make it seem like this is all going to magically go away is a bunch of bullshit. That's what it's going to take. It's going to take an outright war to destroy capitalism. And we may not be prepared for it. And I'm not asking anybody to sell themselves as a soldier. What I'm asking for is criminals. If you have to fight the war against capitalism in your day-to-day actions to get free, that's what you should be doing. There's a diversity of tactics in that, but it is absolutely, what can I do to damage capitalism today? What can I do to damage the plantation that all of us live on today?
So I guess, what I'm hearing you say here is, you know, you're just drawing from all these different ideas and trying to pull from, you know, non-traditional things that leftists, quote unquote leftists, are typically looking at, kind of from with like a, you know, take the best, leave the rest sort of attitude, to each their own.
I'm looting the supermarket of ideas.
Nice. So we haven't talked about the guillotine. That's a amazing, exciting new project you just launched with Brett from Rev Left, who I've had the chance of hanging out with. Great dude. That's a really – it's a really unique show. Can you talk about it a little bit and like what – you know,
sure.
Where the idea came from and what's going on there? What's up with the guillotine?
The guillotine was –
Oh, see, I'm like Brett. I say guillotine.
Yeah, you say it fucked up. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what that is.
It's East Coast shit,
I don't
man.
Know what that is. Maybe. I don't know what the fuck. I mean, you know, now Brett will deny this up and down, but I have heard him say this on several occasions. You know, Brett, he pronounces barbecue as barbecue, and he has said the word quesadilla as quesadilla. So I think maybe his is, but I guess maybe it is a regional thing. You know, I've never asked for Memphis barbecue. Maybe that's a thing out west. I don't know. I don't know if you guys say jalapeno instead of jalapeno, whatever.
No, guillotine, but, man. It's just guillotine. You know, I don't know what's wrong with me.
Who knows? But the way the project started was we had been talking about like doing a project together. I had a lot of fun on his show. We like really clicked. And, you know, there was like a really – the way I looked at it was there's a glut of, you know, anarchist leftist podcasts that are about info, theory. You know, hey, here's this historical figure you should know about. Here's the – you know, all this stuff that's sort of like building the rifle in your head. You know, you're arming yourself with knowledge, which is good. We need that. But no one was putting bullets in a gun. You know, there – no one was talking about the day-to-day struggles of capitalism and how it's fucking the world up and about victories that comrades were doing. They weren't doing it in an audio form. You know, places like Insurrection News, Enough is Enough, are reporting on the literal class war as it exists. But there was no audio format for that. And also, we both had the idea of doing a call-in show because we wanted the show, again, to be a real existing present moment thing. We're talking about things that are happening right now in the world you live in, the details, not necessarily the theories behind them. And then we wanted to open up, well, what do you think about these things? You know, how does it relate to you? Or are there larger things going on that you want to talk about? You know, I mean, the last show we had a caller come in, and, you know, he was had a very, you know, legit question, like, how do you deal with watching all this police violence? You know, there's so much of it, you end up losing the individuals. And how do you deal with all the violence? How do you deal with the horror of seeing this again and again? Because the guy was like, you know, I, after seeing these things, I, you know, get into a rage and I just want to, you know, hurt people. How do you guys deal with it? What's something we can do about it? So again, it's this amazing feedback between people that are living and breathing under the same systems that we keep endlessly critiquing and theorizing and analyzing and planning against. We wanted a show that was put in the present moment, that was actually lived. And also, instead of aiming at people's heads, we wanted to aim at their hearts. You know, what if the United States does something absolutely terrible. We want you to know about it, but we want you to really get a feel for it. What does it feel like? And then we want you to call us and tell us, what is it like? I mean, it was the second episode was amazing because, you know, we had a caller that was descended from the Romani people talking about how the Romani organized, which kicked off a call from a woman from Brazil that talked about how the favelas organized. So in one moment, you had this amazing conversation between anarchists stretching across multiple continents talking about organizing and how it related to the current crisis and issues going on. It was really something, you know, powerful. And it's just been a fascinating ride since the beginning.
You know, I mean, I've tuned in live twice. I was trolling on the YouTube channel. I don't remember what I was saying. I don't even remember. I was just fucking with people, and they couldn't tell I was kidding. So I was like, yeah, whatever. I'll get it. Yeah, it's cool. I mean, that's what to me, that's like the power of it, is that it just leaves it open for, like, you know, for people to interact with it, and you're going to learn shit that way, and other people are going to learn, and it creates this dialogue. And so I'm excited to see how that project develops over the shit. You guys are only on episode 3. It's fun.
Oh yeah. Well, come back when it's fucking 99. God damn. You know, hopefully, who knows? I mean, really, I mean, God knows how we're going to survive the next 2 fucking years, you know, but, I mean, if we don't get collapsed into a nuclear hellscape based on Twitter dick jokes, you know, I mean, that's all sort of like bearing that, you know, the human species will survive a, you know, couple more years.
And I can just see, I mean, I think by 99, I think Brent will have burnt all his Karl Marx books. Who knows, you know?
Oh, yeah. As Brent will be living on a undisclosed ranch somewhere out in the West, will only wear cowboy boots and a gigantic 10-gallon hat with just a red star on it. He'll probably carry 2 shotguns. In each hand. I don't know how he's going to carry him, but he's going to pull it off. Just ride a camel he's just going to be like some kind of like wandering wasteland wizard. He might develop telekinetic powers. You know, the radiation for your guys' region over there is just going to be, I don't know. You got some missile sites and shit like that over there. So who knows? Maybe everyone will just sort of gain superpowers. By episode 99, the hope is that, you know, as the revolutionary moment grows in the United States, I've written about this several times. I think the bomb's really going to hit when automation fully hits. You know, we have 45% of all customer service jobs that to be eliminated by automation, what, like 8 or 6 years? Customer service is the largest employer of people in the United States. 45% of people cut from the largest employer in the United States, largest field. The social safety net is being cut to the point where these people aren't going to have a pot to piss in. It's one thing to argue about politics. It's another thing to argue about politics when your children are hungry and crying. It's one thing to talk about fuck the police at home. It's another thing to say fuck the police when 2 of your friends just had their heads blown off at the last riot for food. The United States has been an extremely comfortable country, and we've also been the epicenter of the empire. Entire nations and entire people have suffered just so that we can continue to get our TV channels and our Big Macs. That's what we've been raised up on. We've also been raised to be the most brutal and efficient killers the world has ever seen. We can invade any country. We can kill anyone we want. This is what we've been born and bred to kill, anyone that stands up against the United States flag. And for what? Our Big Macs and our TVs. And the minute those Big Macs and those TVs go away, you're going to be left with a hell of a lot of very, very pissed off, angry people with no critical thinking skills that are armed to the fucking teeth. And then it will be really, really fun to write about.
Well, you know, and I'm glad you mentioned all that. I mean, of course, we have to add truck drivers is also a huge employer, and that's all about to be automated as well. And when we were talking on the phone, whatever it was, like a month and a half ago, and we were talking about the insurrection stuff, this was also the backdrop to why you think it's important to talk about you know, the more insurrectionary stuff, because like 20, 30, 50 years from now, you know, it's not going to be like these struggles are not going to be so abstract. For me, that's an argument as to why, like, we need to have the best ideas laying around. We need to build capacity. We need to build infrastructure. And while we're advocating for our freedom and our own personal like needs, we should also be spreading all that stuff out and, you know, organizing and whatever. But yeah,
absolutely.
I definitely think I think it's important to tack on what you just said to the insurrectionary.
Oh, well, yeah. And I mean, that's the big thing about, in my mind, egoist communism, because ultimately the application is up to the individual and the individual around them, the union of egoists. I can't describe to you what it may look like in one spot versus another. There is no formula. It's just a set of principles. And again, the whole – when we're looking at the Seminoles, when we're looking at the Hells Angels, when we're looking at the illegalists, when we're looking at mafias, when we're looking at the Underground Railroad, which, mind you, decentralized, no hierarchy, no governing bodies. These were simply people that believed in something and federated amongst individuals. And these people were able to smuggle human beings from Georgia to Canada. How many fucking leftist organizations, if needed to, could smuggle someone from the deep south to Canada without the cops noticing? Nobody. Nobody's got that capacity anymore. So if anything, in egoist communism, we're looking at specific models. Okay, we've learned that hierarchical organizations are very easily infiltrated. We've learned that, you know, building communities that care about one another are the best way to fight against capital. Communities and cells that aren't necessarily federated into large industrial bodies that take things of their own volition, like ELF, like ALF, like the FAI. It's literally analyzing, instead of saying, well, here's the theory and the world needs to conform to the theory. We're saying, okay, we want to be free. We want to be free. We want to be free to live and do what we want. What's the best way to do that? Let's start analyzing. Let's start living it. How can we put that into practice in our life? And as you said, you know, me and my wife were talking about this the other day. One of the things, you know what the left doesn't have? Rough people. Right. Doesn't have.
Some, you know, there are some. There's some. Not enough.
Though. Oh, there's a, no. It's coming. It will happen by sheer necessity. It's going to happen. You know, when you may have to fight your neighbor for food, you're going to get there are going to be really very rough and capable people. And that's what we're coming up to. So now is the time to realize, OK, we're fucked. Let's erase for a moment the idea that, you know, the overthrow of capitalism is just around the corner. Let's dispense with that idea for a minute. Let's imagine that actually the capitalist death machine is going to continue uninterrupted into the millennium, grinding every human soul underneath it until the rich can finally blast off of this planet along with Elon Musk, along with their sex robots and robot slaves, and leave the rest of us here to die of tumors, unbreathable air, and poisoned water. Right. So what the fuck can we do about that? Let's focus on that. Let's start building structures to survive. Let's get in communities going. Let's learn how to garden. Let's learn how to shoot. Let's create the actual world that we want to exist in that can successfully defend itself from a system that wants to keep people in poverty, in ignorance, and dependent upon it. Because at the end of the day, the outlook for the human species is not that great. Planet Earth is definitely not in the lead and unopposed. If, you know, the previous revolutionary and radical struggles have been any sort of guidestone, it is going to be very, very bad for everybody. So we've got to figure out what are the best ways that we can survive, we can create the worlds, and also launch attacks against the same system that is literally going to end up killing us all.
Well, that's why we got to get Bernie in there. 2020. God, thanks.
Oh, yeah, man, fuck, know. Yeah.
Yeah, God.
And Jeb Bush as his running mate. It'll be a true bipartisan ticket right there, you know, which is what America needs.
Bernie and Oprah.
I'm still waiting for what's his name? Not only The Rock to run, but Kid Rock. I'm just hoping like fuck that after Oprah and Trump duke it out, it'll be Kid Rock versus Dwayne The Rock Johnson. So the American election literally just come down to Rock to Rock, which we will have finally slipped into like Neanderthal level, and then everyone can just go and say, well, we tried. We did it. It came down to two guys named Rock. So fuck it. At this point, just walk away. We're done.
What we need is a star with the last name Stick. So it just, you know, the last one.
Oh, there you go. Someone. Oh, and a third candidate paper. Yeah, there you go. The meme harvest would be so good. Delicious.
All right, brother. I ask everybody this, but whatever. Throw out some books. You already mentioned a couple books. So what are some books that that you're geeking out on right now, or some books that you think people should read?
People should read.
If they liked what you had to say, you know, what are some books? Not should, but could.
I would say, obviously, there's this one book that I think has just been fantastic. Definitely my book. Curse Your Boss, Hex the State, Take Back the World. I think a lot of people specifically, I've noticed a lot of, like, spiritual anarchists, because for a long time, the more spiritual aspects of revolutionary organizing have been overlooked. And anything by Gods and Radicals, again, the epicenter for the weird left, the pagan left, anything by them is fantastic. We just had a new book come out. I highly recommend it. One thing I would definitely read, because if any of the ideas that I have discussed about have struck you, okay, let me be the first to say that I am not a detail person. It's not who I am. I'm the more inciting, fiery, bang, bang, shoot 'em up kind of creature running about wildly through the swamps. There have been people that have written about egoist communism that are far, far better than I could even begin to describe it. And one of them is freely available online by a person named D.Z. Rowan. It is called A Brief Description of Egoist Communism. And when I read it, it blew me the fuck away. It sums up so many things and so well that I couldn't believe. I tried to get in contact with this person. I'm like, this is incredible. It for years, they put into perspective everything I've been trying to articulate but was unable to. So I cannot stress enough, if anything about the politics I've been stressing, go check that out. As for if you're interested in, I don't know, any of like the sort of kind of weird shit. If you like weird occult shit and you also like crime, and if you also like the idea of putting hexes on the police, I would highly, highly recommend a book by Professor Charles Porterfield. It's called The Sporting Life. And it's actually a little history of how working people and what Marx might refer to as the lumpen proletariat have used hoodoo to free themselves from the wider capitalist world. Not only that, how LGBTQ folks have organized, how they lived, how they fought, how they used magic, tavern owners, sex workers, again, an entire world that fought for itself as itself without selling itself out and actually used magic to do so. Can't recommend it enough. It's a great history, and you'll also learn the practical techniques they used to protect yourself. The recipes in there to keep snitches away and to keep the cops away should be ingrained in every anarchist's memory. Absolutely. And beyond that, I'm probably just reading some weird shit that most people probably wouldn't be interested in. Taoist sigil craft, all sorts of bizarre, interesting things.
Nice, man. I love that it's called the Sporting Way. Is that what it's called?
No, the Sporting Life. Because okay, funny story about that, real quick. Okay, so the Sporting Life is a British term. It's a Victorian term, and the Sporting Life was like, okay, we want strong, healthy British Victorian men. So here are a set of things that men should do: polo, you know, this, that, and the other. So the term came to America, and the Americans were like, yes, polo. Yes, fitness, as long as it's right next to a whorehouse and contains large, large amounts of whiskey. Abso-fucking-lutely. That's where the term, you know, old sport comes from. So the Sporting Life was this whole sort of underground world. If you were in the Sporting Life, you could be a lot of things. You could be a drug dealer. You could be a sex worker. You could be someone who was gay. You could be someone who was an artist and just wanted to be in it. It was this entire underground world with all its own language and everything like that. And people lived their entire lives and created stories in this world that's been completely forgotten by American history. And not only that, but these people had an entire living, breathing, magical tradition. You know, to think that there were, you know, sex workers in the 1920s, you know, summoning spirits and using psalms and certain herbs and plants to help draw clients, or that, you know, maybe a low down juke joint that was serving booze illegally to folks of color. And also if in a lot of southern states, it was illegal for folks of color and white folks to mix at all in the same building in a sort of free form environment, that they were doing this. And at the same time, they were using cards and roots and herbs and all sorts of shit like that to keep the cops away, to draw business, to keep snitches away, that they were doing all this. It's one of the most fascinating and incredible stories on this continent. I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. The last question for you is, if people will dig what you had to say, if people want to support your work, if people want to follow you online, like, shout out the best places for people to track you.
Okay. Well, I store all my writings. I write for godsandradicals.org. There you can find all my stuff normally, as well as some other fantastic authors. Definitely check them out. My personal website is theconjurehouse.com. I keep all my writings there, podcasts and shit like that. You can also look at, like, hiring me for readings. On Facebook, it's The Conjure House. On Twitter, when I made my Twitter, I was incredibly, incredibly wasted. I mean, I think I killed maybe about 3/4 of a bottle of Everclear. I may have permanently damaged my liver. So I misspelled my own name. It was supposed to be Old Bonesy, but I misspelled it as OLE_BONSEY. So on Twitter, I guess I go as Old Bonesy, and however the fuck you want to call me that. But yeah, there's definitely active on Twitter, definitely active on Facebook. Find my shit on Gods and Radicals. Find my shit on the Conjure House. And of course, again, my book, where I lay out a much, much longer, more in-depth critique of society, capitalism, the media, and as Sol said, sort of detailing how you're getting mind-fucked every day in my book, Curse Your Boss, Hex the State, Take Back the World, available from Gods and Radicals.
Hey, Old Bonzi, thanks for coming on the Soulcast. Thanks for hanging out, and, you know, good luck out there, man.
Yeah, good luck out in the untropical hinterlands of God. I don't know. I don't know how you people live in temperatures below 80. I don't know what that is. I don't know what that life is. I can't imagine mountains and shit like that. That's terrible.
Well, you know, all you got to do is stay put, and you never will have to imagine it. So
thank God for that. As I understand, is it true? And I mean, this is what they say, that people in the Western states literally have to fight away bears when they drop their kids off at school. Radioactive bears, as I understand it.
No, prairie dogs. Radioactive prairie dogs, but not bears.
Yes. The ancient evil prairie dogs. I think I saw them on an Ancient Alien show, right? They're like half human, half bear prairie dog hybrids that like shit pure acid.
I mean actually I don't know, prairie dogs are, you know, I want to say they're communistic, but really they're more dynastic. So I was going to make a joke about communism there, but they're a little hierarchical. So fuck the prairie dogs, man.
Fuck those prairie dogs. You hear that, prairie dogs? Fuck you, and fuck you mole rats too, while we're at it.
We're up all night dreaming. We aren't alive as long as there's a prison guard still breathing. So we're up all night scheming. We don't get tired, we get even.